Before we start today's podcast, I want to encourage you to go to dogbehaviorconference.com and check out this year's Dog Behavior Conference. It's a three-day live online event available to anyone around the world who loves dogs and wants to live their best life together with them. Registration is open now and seats are going fast, so visit dogbehaviorconference.com and reserve your spot today. That's dogbehaviorconference.com. Now, let's get to the podcast. Welcome to the podcast, everybody. Today, we're talking about a really interesting subject with the team. It is called habit stacking. What is that, you may ask? We'll listen on.
Thanks, Vic. This is a topic that is near and dear to my heart because it seemed to scratch an itch that I've had for years, which is that I got so many clients when I was seeing clients in Midtown Atlanta. I saw so many clients that had two-year-old dogs who are displaying types of lunging and barking, what we would call reactive behaviors, and they had taken a puppy class or had they been rescued at like 8 months from the local they had taken out of the local shelter, and they went to a dog training class for 6 weeks and they said they did really well. But now they're experiencing some reactivity and they don't have any of the skills that they had in those classes. So it's been a year and a half, 2 years, and yet all of that great learning and effort and time and money they put in is gone. And it was like every client that I'd had, or even if they hadn't done a training class, it was that they had done training on their own and they said, well, he knows sit. And I feel like they can always go into the kitchen and they ask the dog to sit. They usually cue two or three times, but then the dog sits and then he gets they get half a milk bone, and yeah, they do sit. So I'm thinking, okay, so there's something about that. We remember this one thing in this one place and we've got that down, but where's the disconnect between sitting for a cookie in the kitchen and not doing or remembering our other things? What's fun is that once I start to get treats out with this dog, he's offering a lot of behaviors. So I'm like, oh my goodness, you do remember these things. So what's common in dog training is we see that it may not be the dog, it's the people. So this topic I'd like to talk about is called habit stacking. And I found this idea in the book Atomic Habits, which is an amazing book I was reading it for myself and trying to change habits on my end. And I thought about, I couldn't stop making analogies with dogs. And so I started to play around with my clients of, okay, maybe part of this reason, I said, well, why? And this is going to touch a topic for me. So I'm just checking in with myself. But one thing that I feel that other people that maybe use shock collars and prong collars do a good job of is that their clients stick with it. I think that if you read the little booklet on the prong collar, it says you're only supposed to use it for like 2 weeks until the dog learns to quote unquote heal. It was only ever meant to be a training collar. But anyways, people will use a prong collar for years and years and years. So they always put it on and they always remember. And same thing with shock collars. Even if your dog, some people say it doesn't even need it anymore, they put the shock collar on and they carry the remote with them. Why is it that so many people that use shock collars carry the remote with them, and yet when we get people that we ask them to carry treats with them, they can't carry the treats with them? So I'm like, okay, so the aversive trainers are doing something right. What is it that they're doing right? How do they get these people to stick with this habit? And how can we do that as positive trainers? So that's what I was thinking about habit stacking, that rather than teaching the dog in like a 30-minute session to wait at the door and putting it on cue and expecting the dog to wait and sit and wait for 3 to 5 seconds while the person turns around, opens the door, walks through it and releases them, where does this disconnect? So part of the issue, I think, is that I'll teach the dog to wait successfully in no time flat. We can do this. We're positive trainers. We do it pretty fast. The person then, we hand it off, and it's a decent handoff, and the person can demonstrate this skill. But I come back next week, maybe they do it. Like 2 weeks later, we're already on to leash walking. We're already on to something else. But the dog doesn't do it. I say, well, what happened? Our weight falls apart. And it's because the person gets busy and they need to walk the dog and they forget. And certainly 6 months down the road, we're not waiting at the door. So I like to think of it as habit stacking of, I like to teach, instead of teaching them the full behavior on cue, on verbal cue of sitting at the door, it's, can you just this week, before you leave the door, can you just grab a treat and give it to your dog and walk out the door? Because even if the dog, they turn around, they give a treat, the dog is now learning that something happens at the door, something good. If I turn and look at my person, something good happens. They're not necessarily even waiting. And then the next week, they would wait for 2 seconds. One Mississippi, two Mississippi, give it to your dog. The third week, they open the door, close the door, give their dog the treat. Now we're up to 3 seconds. And then the following week, they're opening the door, turning around, saying, wait, giving their dog the treat. And this is still taking 3 seconds tops. So by the fifth and sixth week, we're actually putting it on the verbal cue of waiting and getting it through. But I'm demonstrating each week for them to do this. So my question to the team is, have you ever done this yourselves? What do you think of this idea of teaching on the go in 3 second increments versus going and trying to teach it? Like, why is it that we seem to have to teach it all at once and it has to be perfect and then go? I'd love to know your experience with your clients as well. But how do you incorporate habits and to make the training last?
I think you raise such an important point that people who are learning are really eager, and when they're first doing it and learning like something like a wait at the door, and then it sort of kind of fizzles a little bit. But actually creating habits in people, well, we talk about creating habits for dogs too, but actually creating habits in people can be really, really difficult. And so I think this is a great way to create a habit for a person as well. And so just giving like small, really simple, easy things to do that you build on, it means that, you know, you don't have to have the finished polished behavior and it becomes part of your everyday life. And surely that's what teaching life skills, which waiting at the door is, isn't it?
Yeah, I love this idea, Allie, and I love the idea. I think it's good training, right? It's good training for people. It's good training, as you just said, Victoria, it's good training for dogs. We know, I'm going to get a little nerdy here, but we know that when we're trying to create an association, it doesn't matter how many times you do it. It matters that they're always together. So if you do 4 reps, but then you do another 4 reps where 2 things aren't paired, and you do just 4 reps, you will have the same amount of pairing, right? In fact, you might even have more with the just 4 reps. When you have the contingency, the door opens, the treat comes out. And that's true for dogs, but it's true for people as well. So when you start them simply like that, when they don't have to do anything but reach for the treat, you are teaching them the foundation for building the contingency there for their dog. And you're doing it in a way that where the door becomes the cue for them just to grab the treat, just as the door will become the cue for their dog to wait. The only thing I would ask you is, why include the wait? Why include the verbal cue?
I think, so for me, a lot of this was, especially working with clients displaying reactive behaviors, was that they felt like they had a really big problem, and they felt like their dog was, they just felt like there was something wrong with their dog. And that this wasn't doable, and that we needed to work on some sort of aggression training around other dogs. And what I wanted to show them is, I kind of use wait at the door as a foundation for their understanding. They took a training class, usually some sort of training class, or they understand that if I use a treat, I give it to my dog. But what I find is that people don't truly understand what cues the dog. And so I want them to know what cues the dog. So it doesn't even have to be wait, but I think that's a great point, Maya, is it could just be the door. And what I like to show them, even I may teach them the word wait at the door, but then we'll troubleshoot. So if, cause that's week 5, if on week 6, we say, let's find out what the cue actually is. Cause I like the people to think that it's door, wait, the word wait. But then when we find out, I say banana when you do it. And so they'll go through, because they want to show, they want to show off, they want to do their homework and show me how great their dog is waiting at the door. Now they say banana and the dog still does it. And I said, this time I don't want you to say anything, but I want you to mouth the word wait. And the dog still does it. Now I don't want you to say anything. And so now they're starting to see, I have a bit more investment because I've shown that their dog can do the thing. They can make their dog do the thing. And then now we're seeing that that's actually not what is cueing their dog. So I also want to teach them. It's like the broccoli and the brownie batter of what is the cue. But I think you are right, Maya, that we do want to be mindful of why we make it more complicated. Ideally, I would like for the cue for waiting at the door to be the door opens and the person doesn't walk through. So the cue to walk forward through a door is that the person walks through the door. Now you can, or some people like to put it on the verbal, okay, or release or free or whatever. But I think for reactivity, I like to show, especially for reactivity in the high rises where I was working, I need them to see that teaching your dog to wait for you to look around the corner is a really vital skill. So they weren't worried about their dog's behavior in the hallway or before they got to a dog. They were worried about their dog lunging and barking at other dogs or people. So I think it was also part of the foundation of teaching them that your dog needs, we can help your dog be in a better headspace by looking to you for things and thinking before they bust out the door, right, from leaving your home.
I think the answer to the question why the verbal cue wait, it's because of the humans thinking we need a verbal cue, we need a word because we're a verbal species. And I think it's a, like you said, Allie, it's mind-blowing to most clients when they actually watch. Their dog doesn't need the verbal cue. You actually taught them the environmental cue, and it's in many ways so much more powerful for the dog. The word is just for us in most cases.
Sorry, I know I'm unmuting myself. I started to talk and realized, am I still muted? Can you hear me?
No, I can hear you.
I realized that doing this means that we are not making or commanding the dog from on high. It's almost like we are. It just seems to me it's more of a sort of organic, it's an organic way of living with your dog. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I totally see it. And the light bulb moment for me, I think we talked about this last time we were doing this, but I still have to bring it up. And I really try and work on his name, Chirag, right? I believe that's how you pronounce it. Chirag Patel's method of drop blew my mind. I feel like it's a training hack. Of he just drops the treats on the ground for a while, just drops treats, points them out, and then eventually adds the word drop. Or I mean, think right away, he adds the word drop, but that just makes drop. And I use that with my clients. And in a week, they taught their dog to drop nearly almost anything out of their mouths, other than we still work with chicken bones in Atlanta on the road. That takes a little more than a week. But that was a light bulb moment for me to see that in my mind at the time as a baby trainer, I was like, that's the opposite of what normally I have to give the dog the thing to drop it. And so to start dropping it without the thing, I thought that's a training hack that's worth exploring. What can we do? How can we hack other things? And then once I started on hacks, it was like, how do I make it so that people can start to understand how training actually works? Because I think that's a disservice that we're doing, that as a group class trainer, I love teaching group classes. I think that was a disservice that happens in group class, is that folks come out knowing how to train in this environment, in this one place, and they don't really understand how to apply it, how to proof it, how to do other things without becoming a mini dog trainer themselves. Sure, you have those clients that really geek out and get really into it, but the average trainer, the average client that's coming in, how do we help them understand? And I think breaking this down, once they realize that the treats come like a jackpot, I think with that sort of hack, they start to realize, oh. So I think the future of positive training is taking these hacks for people and pairing them with people's existing habits to help their everyday. Because I think expecting people to pay for training, care about their dog, of course they want to care about their dog, but want to make this change. Behavior change is so hard that we're having two beings change their behavior. So I want to try and not have the human change their behavior that much because they're already learning. They're already doing all this stuff. And what can I do in their regular schedule? So I just like to watch my clients move around with their dog as they would. Take a walk with them, watch how they walk, and see what little management and training I can add to make their life work in like 3 seconds or less.
I love the really breaking it down. And I think the way that I think about this is we focus so much on in the ABCs, we focus on the behavior. We have to teach the dog the behavior and then we'll teach them the cue. Mm-hmm. But the dog already knows how to wait. She already stands still sometimes in her life, right? So our real goal here is to say, when this happens, if you do this, then this will happen next. And I just think if we back chain everything, if we start by teaching the consequence first, and we teach the consequence in a smart way so that the client is consistent and it's not a burden for them, then we get consistency from that behavior. And it is easier and it does feel more natural. I mean, that maybe that's part of why my own preference is not to use the word wait. It's just, we're going to the door together. I'm not telling you what to do, but you'll do what you do and I will do what I do. There's an agreement here.
This is really not unlike the way that humans learn. I'm thinking like, okay, well, you know, my son is 14 now. Crazy. Anyway, so if we walk to the door, he's not barely in front of me. You know, it's whoever reaches for the door handle. Everybody else just kind of stands and waits their turn kind of thing. So those are, if you look at it, those are all cues that he's learned, that we've all learned. And absolutely, why shouldn't we be using these exact cues and teach the dog in that way? But yes, back chaining it that way. Yeah, that's brilliant, actually.
Yeah, I love the idea of back chaining everything. And Lorena, just to piggyback before Maya takes over and explains more of her back chaining everything, because I love that. Just the idea of like, how do you teach a child to wait at doors? If you think about it, what parent says, okay, today we're going to work on wait. They get their toddler, they get their M&Ms, they go to the door and they say, okay, today we're going to work on this. And they spend 30 minutes of their time setting up this training session and telling their kid, now when I open the door, we stand there and we wait, and you get an M&M. We don't do that. We also don't, when the kid goes to get in front of us, we don't yank them and shock them and say no. Because they don't know. We don't do that. We usually say, oh, wait your turn, honey. And it's a process. And like, yeah, maybe we do it more aversively than we'd like sometimes. But generally, we do that. So thanks, Lorena, for using that example, because I think it's brilliant. And I would like to hear more about, or go ahead, Tiffany, but I'd like to hear more about Maya's back chaining everything, because I feel like this, we need a shirt, just back chaining everything.
Back chain everything. No, I was just going to reiterate kind of what you said, Allie. It's brilliant to think of it that way. And that it's just part of your natural day with this other family member. So the same way that your child learns from you and the cues that you give and the way that you do things and the way you interact in a natural everyday way, helping clients to understand to do that with their dogs, another family member, not directly relating them to children in every way, but in many ways, the teaching and the understanding and the cueing and the allowing it to fit more organically throughout your day is really what I love to get across to clients, as opposed to, like you said, Allie, the okay, 30 minutes, we're gonna strap on a treat pouch and just focus on the door. And, you know, it's hard to fit those things into a busy life. And it's not necessary in order to get the results you want. If you just do it in a more organic way, then I've seen much better results that way.
Yeah, we did have a comment from somebody that says she does like to teach the wait cue because you can use it elsewhere. It's like, yes, if you put it on a verbal cue, then you can use it elsewhere. And I do like to, especially if we're going to use it at different places, name it something, or there's something you can do with your body. And a lot of times I think the dog is actually watching your body more than they're listening to your voice. So I like to talk to clients too about maybe 1 week is just, like I said, my second week is just turning the body. So the first week, because clients are going to give the treat and usually face the dog. But sometimes I like to turn the body and do that. I actually had a whole class of, I worked in canine cellmates and was going into Fulton County Jail and teaching a group class in there. And there was one time, I think it was a 10-week program, and 6 weeks in, we started teaching loose leash walking. And if you think about it, before that, we taught down, sit, all that jazz, and everything is facing the dog. When you ask a dog to sit, just normally people face square up to the dog, they say sit, or they give the dog a treat right here. Same thing with down. And then all of a sudden, we expect that the dog is magically going to know that when we do loose leash walking, we now want them here facing the same direction as us. Mind blowing. That, like, how is this dog supposed to gather that? So when they do leash walking, the dog is usually trying to come and sit and stare at them and getting in the way, and they don't understand why this is happening. So one of my classes, the guys and I, actually the same guys from this thing before, and I said, guys, do you want to try this experiment with me where we teach the dog from the very beginning to do everything from the side as like a police officer would? And they said, yeah, let's do it. So we did that, and it was awesome. We never had to teach them to stay at our side for leash walking. We didn't even really have to teach it because they already did it. So the context of that's one thing I would say is that's why I like to teach clients about cueing and what is troubleshoot that cueing to see what's happening. In fact, I would like to pivot and think about, we've talked a little about wait at the door, but what are some hacks and some habits that we can help people with when it comes to loose leash walking? How are some ways that we can incorporate that into their everyday lives?
Maya, I think you have some awesome ideas on that. I've seen it in action, so that's why I know.
This might be a bit of a cheat, but I do think one of the very first things that we can do for many dogs is get them a longer leash. We can't teach loose leash walking if we're getting no steps on a loose leash. And 6 feet or 2 meters, that is a very short distance for most sizes of dogs, except for the very smallest of dogs. Having a leash that's 12 feet or 15 feet or 3 meters, that is a leash that can get your interspecies walking speeds when you're first teaching this to match up enough that you can start to get some of the behavior that you like.
Can I just second that? Oh, sorry. I just a couple of days ago was working with probably the strongest puller shepherd Labrador collie mix that I've ever worked with, more than any of the Great Danes or Irish Wolfhounds, whatever I've worked with. And they had her on a very short leash. And one of the best things, that's one of the first things I did, was obviously got to be in an area where it's safe, but I put her on a longer leash, and the difference was immediate. And then from then we could have worked, but I just wanted to say second, third, fourth, yep, and yes.
Yes. And I see a comment that there are leash laws that sometimes specify the length of leash. You can do this inside. You can do this in a yard. You can do this in many places if it's not legal for you to do it out on the street. So yeah, I'm totally with you on that. And then the other thing that really blew my mind, somebody taught me this. I wish I could remember who first said it to me because I would give them credit. They changed how I teach loose leash walking. I think it was Jesus Rosales Ruiz. But he said, stop reinforcing outcomes and start reinforcing behavior. So we often say we will treat when the leash is loose, but leashes don't behave. And dogs can have a loose leash while they are trotting forward at a speed that means that they're about to hit the end of the leash. We didn't feed the loose leash. We fed a speed that's going to result in pulling. So by looking at, okay, what is the pace? How do I want my dog's body to move? That and feeding that, reinforcing that in position, as you said, Allie, or off to the side, like off so that the dog moves away from you and can learn to come back. That too really, really helps. Don't feed the outcome, feed the behavior that produces the outcome. That was a big light bulb moment for me.
We had a comment about running with your dog, and I think that is brilliant. If you're able, yeah. Pace changes are everything. And I think I run with my dogs. I do canter cross with my dogs. It's a big, big thing for me in life. And I have clients that if they're active, and I have a lot of clients that are canter cross clients too, that want to run with their dogs pulling in harness, and they also want to be able to have loose leash walking, which you can absolutely do. And I think context cues are amazing around those two different things. And yes, it can be really helpful to get to go the speed your dog wants. I also think for a hack for that, many times, like in the high rises where I worked, I would do canine conditioning inside and do some exercises with the dog inside. Or if you have a backyard, have your dog go warm up first, but then run around the backyard and then go on a walk. I also ask clients, like, what is the purpose of this walk? Is this just to go out and potty? Is this to have fun for you? Is this to have fun with your dog? If the purpose is for exercise for you, maybe you don't take your dog, or you do take your dog, or I will go do my main run by myself, and then I'll do my cool down lap with my dog. So there's a lot of different ways too that we can like interact with our dogs and think about the type of walks we want to do. At VSA, we talk about sniffy walks, where it's mostly for the dog, like a dog led walk versus a human led walk, where you take a nice long line, you try and match the dog's pace and let them sniff. I've seen, I think one of our students had a shirt, let them sniff, which I loved. Of it's not this idea of just walking forward and trudging, but it's letting the dog sniff. But I think that's, for me, a big hack for leash walking is I like to teach go sniff, or go find it, where I'll toss treats. We go find it on a long line, and then I'll take treats in my hand. We'll walk a couple good steps, and then I toss them again, go find it. It's almost like I have a cat, like a fishing line. I'm casting them out and about, so I'm capturing that nice leash walking, then letting them go sniff and things like, and then we start to build up that the distance of our walks or the duration in our walks. But the other thing is I do like to have an out for clients. So on days when they just can't, they don't have time, I always want to give them an option. And usually it's management. It's like giving them the positively harness that they can walk with. So they say, I literally can't. My dog pulls so hard. I need some help, please. I just need to take him out for a quick pee and back. Like that will at least, we can walk forward maybe does that reinforce position. But I'd be interested on the team's thoughts on at least having your dog in position, or what can a client do as like a hack for an out of, I just need to take my dog out to pee.
It's my favorite weekend of the year. Okay, maybe after Thanksgiving and my daughter's birthday. But it really is something I look forward to all year long, the Dog Behavior Conference. It seems like I say this every year, but it really is true. The 2024 lineup of Dog Behavior Conference speakers has me as fired up as I've ever been for what I truly believe is the most meaningful, enlightening, impactful, and inspirational event available to dog geeks like you and me anywhere in the dog world. With speakers including returning favorites like Sarah Fisher, Mike Shikashio, Arit Bloom, Andrew Hale, and Sarah Heath, to newcomers like Robert Hewings, Marty and Mikhail Becker, Lisa and Brad Wagner, and more, the range of topics covered is custom tailored to serve you no matter where you are on your dog journey, a wide-eyed newbie figuring things out for the first time, or a longtime professional trainer or shelter rescue worker looking to fine-tune your skills and knowledge. It seems like everywhere you turn now since COVID, someone is offering yet another online event, course, or conference, promising the latest and greatest in dog training knowledge. But we've been doing this for over a decade, including in-person dog behavior conferences since 2010, to accompany our longtime Victoria Stillwell Academy and Positively.com courses for guardians and pet pros alike. So go to dogbehaviorconference.com now to check out the DBC and secure your seat today. Registration is open and available to you wherever you are in the world. The live event happens from April the 19th to the 21st, but you'll automatically get access to all of the recordings from the conference for 12 months. So it's okay if you can't join us live for some or all of the weekend. The DBC is special, and I'd hate for you to miss it. So visit dogbehaviorconference.com now to get your ticket. That's dogbehaviorconference.com. And now, back to the podcast.
Well, one thing I was going to mention even before you brought that up, so I think it kind of transitions well, is you mentioned context cues for the difference between if you're running with your dog versus it's just a sniffy walk or something. I had my dog, Cosmo, when we did nose work together, he had a specific harness that I used, and that meant he could lead and pull and I would follow because he was searching and I wanted him to lead and search. And a different harness he had for our loose leash walking, our casual walks around the neighborhood. And just the different harness was enough for him to understand the context, to understand what are we doing? What is my job here? What is the plan? So when I put this on, so potentially in some cases, I think that could be an easy hack for some clients. It, you know, one type of harness or one type of leash or something like that could be for when we are working on this specific task or teaching this specific behavior. And okay, right now I just have to get you down to a patch of grass to pee. So maybe use a different harness or leash potentially. I like the harness option myself. It worked well for me.
Yeah, I like that too. And also, could we just sort of state that dogs don't really walk in straight lines? Humans walk in straight lines. Dogs, when you watch them naturally, they're all over the place. So it's a real skill to teach a dog how to walk with a human in a straight line, right? That's number one. Number two, the dog's pace is going to be naturally faster than ours. And we have to realize that when they are potentially like the one I was just working with, we have to respect the fact that they are going to have to inhibit that pace a little bit, that they are going to have to learn that skill of walking with us. And I also think sort of doing that kind of speed up and slow down and encouraging them to sort of dance with you. I see teaching this loose lead walking like a dance. And first of all, the steps, you're going to tread on each other's toes. But when you get it, it is absolute. It feels like dancing. It's just, you know, you're one with each other. And I'm totally for the hack of that, of course, positively no pull harness. And even though I have designed this harness and I do use it a lot for big pullers, I am absolutely 100% in. I want to teach my dog the skill. I don't want to have to rely on anything to teach my dog the skill. But if you do need to have that, like, okay, I have no time, I got to get my dog out, then do use a harness like that just to help you. So yeah, let's just all remember that dogs don't do straight lines.
Yeah, and what you said, Victoria, reminds me too. I think we think of loose leash walking as a skill, but because dogs don't walk in straight lines, there are many skills: speeding up, slowing down, turning back, catching up, waiting. All those skills are in there, and it really is a dance. And it's a dance mm-hmm. for people too. We also, I think, can do a better job of teaching humans the dance. The dance involves actually handling the equipment, the leash. And when I worked with horses, there was a lot of attention to how you held your reins and how you moved your halter and your lead rope. And an instructor would show you that. And I think we can do that with dogs as well and take a little time. Teach them this dance, you know, when they're going the leash over the top of the head. There are all sorts of ways that we can do it and keep it loose. And I saw a comment in here about what happens when my dog has a nice heel, but how do I teach loose leash walking? And I just wanted to point back to what Allie said, teaching find it. So tossing a treat off to the side, waiting for your dog to eat it and return to you inside and taking a step and tossing again, that can help teach the skill of I go away. And when I get to the end of the leash, I come back to you, which is a different skill than I stay right in position, right? It's another skill of loose leash walking that healing doesn't require. So you can break it down into skills and you can teach it using the find it.
I also really like just marking and treating for the dog looking forward, because that was a big thing. Klaus was always looking up at me, and we were actually getting some muscle atrophy on one side. So getting him just to look forward, walking him on both sides, but reinforcing looking forward can be really helpful as well. I was just thinking, Maya, that my dog got so much better at loose leash walking after I taught him to pull. And I think many people wouldn't think about that. But when we started doing canicross, which is pulling, it's a dog powered sport where I'd run behind him and he'd pull. You don't have to run. You can canny hike as well. They have really awesome leverage belts. So for people, it goes around your booty, and your dog can pull on a bungee leash, and he's in a sled dog harness. So it's evenly distributed. Everything is like perfectly sized for you, for the dog. And it's so comfortable. And I love walking hands-free that way, but he pulls on that. And you teach him to pull just the same as you teach him to loose leash. So you want to encourage that behavior. You reinforce that behavior. There's courses out there teaching your dog to pull. But that was really helpful for teaching him to then loose leash walk. One hack that I have for teaching people, especially in the city, when we have these small dog runs, or if you have a yard, is I like to capture the dog walking nicely, as the people would say, on the way back. So I say, is there ever a time when you like the way your dog walks? He goes, yeah, when he's dog tired. I'm like, okay. So he does walk at human speed at some time. So let's go play in the park. Let's run around. Let's do our thing. And then on the way back, let's bring treats, and we can add our word, and we can start to do the kind of traditional leash positive training while we're walking back. So we have that moment of capturing. I also talk about that. I'll have people go out in the positively harness, have their normal walk, and then they come back in and we change into maybe collar leash or a different harness, and we go back out just for like 2 minutes. And we just go up and down the driveway and back. So if our walk was going to be 20 minutes, we come back 15 minutes, so 5 minutes early, we go out, we go to the driveway and back, and we work on loose leash walking. And then every time we'll just start to, instead of doing 15 minutes in our management harness and 5 minutes, we'll just start to get longer and longer in with our loose leash walking harness, if that makes sense to anybody. But I think that's helpful. That's my hack of like over the weeks, if people start to see that we have, I've heard the analogy, more deposits in the bank of goodness, or what we're looking for, which again, there is no good or bad or whatever, but nice and wrong, but more of what people want to see.
So it's really setting up your dog for success. So yes, taking the dog out for a loose leash walk right after coming home from work, for example, chances that you're going to get that behavior that you're after are probably really tiny, because your dog is raring to go. So yes, thinking about, okay, how can my dog, you know, what's the likelihood that my dog's going to be more successful in the situation? What can I do? What can I present to him so that he's more, you know, in this case, just let loose, you know, go out there, get your zoomies, you know, wherever, whether it's in the backyard or at the dog park or whatnot. And then let's go ahead and do a nice walk with that. That's definitely a huge, huge thing that I think most pet parents don't even think about. It's just kind of like, okay, well, let's just go ahead and do it. And we got to help them out. That's really, really important, because again, they think like us in some ways, but in other ways, absolutely not. It is like dealing with a toddler, dealing with a young kid. So
I love that, Lorena. I mean, we wouldn't ask a starving dog to leave food. And by using satiation, by allowing the dog to have the physical movement, if that's what they're seeking, or sniffing, and those might be different. So figuring out why your dog is pulling now, and figuring out a way to give them access to that so that they're full, they're satiated before you ask them to learn this new skill. That's a really important way that you can have a much less frustrating time teaching it. And probably your dog does too.
I'm just thinking, attending to all their needs really too. I've seen some folks, especially in these high rises, if their dog really has to potty and we want perfect walking to the elevator. And I'm thinking how many times I have sprinted down my own hallway having to potty. And then I'm tiptoeing, walking as fast as I can. So we do want to be mindful of the dog's needs when we're teaching these different behaviors, especially loose leash walking, that we're expecting them to, after, especially if we've held it like all day or something like that. Are there any other hacks, training hacks, or habit loops that come to mind that y'all love to utilize with clients or your own dogs?
I have one more to add that I learned from Emily Larlam of Kiko Pup. And that is, if you have a puppy, if you have a young dog who's going to grow a lot, don't walk at the pace that you will walk as an adult. If you do, their little legs will be traveling twice as fast as they should be to produce loose leash walking. So I think she calls this slow pacing your puppy, but look down at your puppy and find the gait at which they're ambling. Each foot is moving separately. They're not trotting with 2 feet moving together, but each foot is moving separately. That's how fast you should walk your little puppy. Because otherwise they'll grow, and as their body changes, they'll be doing the exact same behavior with a bigger body, and all of a sudden you don't like it. But you just reinforced it for the first months of their life. So slow pace your puppies if you are lucky enough to have a puppy, and you can kindly teach this from the beginning.
You know, what I love, what I absolutely love that. I think that is really considering, truly considering the dog and preparing. It's almost like as well that, you know, and again, this is a different subject, but sort of preparing your dog to be a senior dog, you know, preparing your dog to maybe not be able to do all the things that your dog has been able to do as an adult. So that's almost like, yeah, preparing your puppy to, and helping you, truly, that's what Lorena says. It's like setting your dog up for success, your puppy up for success when that puppy becomes an adult. I absolutely love that. And I think, you know, training classes are, I'm not saying don't take your dog to training classes, but I do think that sometimes it actually reinforces maybe behavior that you don't want in your dog. And, you know, they learn a lot in a short space of time. And in one way that's good, but in another way, it's like, why, what is in it for the dog, and how can we make it easier, as easy as possible? So I absolutely love what, from Kika, what she does. And I just think it just, again, we consider the dog at all times. It's almost like what I say is, you know, consider if you've got a small dog, consider what that small dog, how that dog perceives the world and what it's like for that dog. So I love it.
Yeah. I remember my group, I was passionate about group classes and like making them as effective as private training if you can, and like really utilizing the space, in the sense that like it's not very often that you get this many dogs around each other working at a time, and that's really what we should focus on. So I know in my group classes, the first thing I sent out was a video of how to teach your dog to settle on a mat. And so all dogs were expected to settle on a mat in some way, in some form, before they even came to class. And we'd talk about it on the phone, or we'd have a Zoom session before, and we'd work on that in a remote session. And so then when they came to class, it was almost like we were having a workshop with a bunch of dog trainers. It was amazing, even though they were just people. But I don't know if that much consideration is given in other group classes so that the dog can, because I feel like the whole first like class and a half is just getting dogs comfortable in that space. And also like allowing dogs to sniff and feel safe in that space and feel safe enough to be able to learn is tough. I imagine it's the same with kids. I've never taken a kid into kindergarten, but I imagine the first time you walk in your kindergarten classroom, it takes, I would be interested to know how long it takes a kindergarten class to be able to actually sit down and learn the topic that was planned to teach.
If you've done it well, it should be pretty quick. It should be pretty quick. If you've prepared, but I don't think a lot of parents think about preparing their kid for kindergarten and all of the skills that that kid is going to need. And I think it's a really, really good point.
That was what my puppy kindergarten class was looking at, from the teaching end. It was looking at what kindergarten teachers expect kids to be able to do. So like they needed to be able to pay attention for, I think it was a storybook. And so how long is a storybook? And it was just really interesting to look at those learning objectives that kindergarten teachers have. But I want to get back to what Maya said about thinking about slow pacing your puppy, because I think that can apply to a lot more things of not even just loose leash walking, but it applies to jumping. So if we talk about it as trainers a lot, if we're reinforcing the puppy for jumping up because they're small and adorable, what is that going to look like in a few months? But also thinking about the future state of your training. So yes, we are doing these training hacks, but we're thinking about what does it look like where you want to use it. So like somebody brought up using weight at a curb. So it's like, well, why don't we go out and practice on the least distracting curb we can think of and practice in different environments? I know Maya is a big fan of practicing in multiple environments, even before using it like in context, but I do think it's really helpful for people. And yes, it's helpful for the dogs, of course, but it's helpful for people to think about, why are you teaching this and how are you going to use it? So like, how long does your dog actually need to wait or stay or whatever for what you want to do? This isn't just, I don't know how I feel about the exercise of just having your dog down, stay in a big field and seeing how long he can go. Like it's, I mean, if you're playing it for fun, sure. But if we think about, I just want to be able to grab my car keys and come back while he's muddy, or I just want to be able to go grab a towel while he's muddy and have him stay in one place. Like, how long does that take? How far do you have to go? Where is the towel located? I think you can hear from experience, this is something that I have done, but just thinking about where you're going to use it and then training to that level.
Yeah. And specifically with weight, Allie, is it necessary that they sit? Is it necessary that they lie down? Can they just stand still? Like Maya said, a dog knows how to do already. And can you just build on that and take advantage of the fact that they already know how to do that? And you just need them to do that for a little bit longer so you can go grab that towel. I love the fact that we, as you know, a profession, are really starting to rethink the requirement of putting your bottom on the ground or putting your elbows and belly on the ground for no apparent reason other than the fact that we said so or we think it should be. I love that we're starting to rethink what is necessary for what I actually need. And like you said, for real life or in the future.
And that loops around to what we talked about in the first place of, why are you teaching your dog to wait at the door? Is it because you are the alpha and need to walk out first? No, it's because your dog is lunging and barking at other dogs and you live in a high rise. And we need to make sure that you peek your head out first to see if there's another dog around the corner so that we can. And they're like, oh, I didn't think about that. Like, yep. So we want to limit those interactions. So yes. And of course, we're not talking about alpha dogs here, but it's something that the clients don't think about that with reactive dogs. They're like, oh yeah, I didn't think about, I should check before he does, because he always knows when the dog's coming.
That's funny, because you say reactive dogs, and I think that really leads right into reactive humans. And when it comes to that kind of a thing, really helping our clients understand the whole concept of, let's make this as easy as we can for our dogs, is a very, it's a very different concept than what they're used to. Just want the dog to calm down, stop the lunging, stop doing that already. And I think a big part of our job is for us to help them understand the things that they can do to help the dog have a better success. So things like, for example, yeah, let's check and make sure there's no dog in the hallway. That's going to help, because if there is a dog in the hallway, let's wait until they go back into their apartment or whatever the case might be. But in order for the dog to wait for, as you're checking out that the coast is clear, dog kind of needs, okay, what does the dog need to be able to do in order for you to be able to do that? And looking at it from that perspective, I think it just makes more sense. And it makes this whole training thing just that much more powerful. It's not just training as in my dog will listen to my cues and respond. It's life skills.
I love what I'm hearing about. Love what I'm hearing about. It's like you're becoming a team. You know, you're thinking, what's best for the team? So the team needs safety. The team needs a beat or two before they step out the door, because you don't know what's coming down. Even if you're not in a high rise, you know, we have high hedges here, and we don't always know, although the dog can pick it up with his nose pretty quick. But just setting up habits so that life together is easier, and taking into account I love these remarks in the comments. People are talking about their different size dogs or different short neck dogs or different, like, you're not going to treat every dog the same. You're not going to, like, puppies and long legged adult dogs, but the team, you're thinking of the team as like that dance Victoria talks about.
Yeah. And I was thinking about the difference in dogs in different environments, but also just making it really easy for the people of, like, wouldn't your life be easier, person, if your dog didn't react and we didn't have to go through this embarrassment? It kind of all comes full circle to the whole point of this was to make it easier for the person. This is really all about people, these hacks. It's to help them easily understand how training works and why training works. It's about helping them easily understand it's about a habit. You know, I used to practice piano every day for like 20 years and I can't play piano. I think I can play Fur Elise, but that is because that's the song I practice the most, but I can't play piano at all. I used to be able to sight read anything. And how crazy is it that 20 years of my life, you know, and now it's been 10 removed and it's gone. So this skill I had is totally gone because I didn't practice. And I think it's not a wonder why, you know, people they get really pumped about getting a dog, which is great. And they get really pumped about going to training, which is great. And then it falls off the wayside because life gets in the way. So how can we as trainers help them keep up these habits and realize that training is like a lifestyle? Teaching your dog is a lifestyle, and that every opportunity, is a learning experience. Every learning experience is an opportunity. Every opportunity is a learning experience of walking out the door, seeing other dogs, doing all these things. And yeah, kind of wrapping up what we said earlier about fulfilling the dog's needs and keeping them safe, but also keeping ourselves safe. So thinking about how can we give them an out as well, the people. How can we help them get all this done? Because it probably seems pretty overwhelming to them as well. So what are some ways that you've helped clients in the past kind of feel less overwhelmed and get training done?
I think what I like to do is just, Ali, is we're you know, developing courses that it's really important to check out what their next week looks like. What does your next week look like? And if you are really busy, fine. We'll just work on one thing. If you have a pretty clear week, then we'll do more. I think it's truly we have to meet the dog where it's at, but also meeting the person where it's at too, where they're at. So that's one of the things that I like to do, is to check in to see actually how much you can do. Because I do feel when people are under pressure, it's as bad as when dogs are under pressure. When people are under pressure, then they're likely not going to do what, you know, the hours of homework that you're giving them. So just one thing, fine. One thing.
Yeah, that's such a good point, Vic, because I've worked with so many clients, and the first time in-home private session, I walk in and I can't believe how many things that they're kind of built up. They're ashamed that their dog does this, or they're worried that I'm going to judge that, or they've been told by somebody else that they have to use these specific cues, even to the point of they have a German Shepherd, so they have to learn German to cue their dog. I mean, I've heard it all. It's like, and just bringing some relief. Like, wow, you mean I don't have to do it this way, or I don't have to use that specific word? And I'm like, no, this is you and your life and your dog and your home and your family. As long as everybody is staying safe and happy, and, you know, obviously we're using positive methods and we're not hurting or intimidating, then you get to pick the words. You get to decide which behaviors you need in your home and in your life with your dog. And you get to decide what fun games and interactions you play. Don't let someone else tell you how you have to, you know, live your life with your dog, or specific things. The amount of relief that I've seen on people's faces when I just, you know, give them permission, I guess, for lack of a better word, to let all that other stuff go and really focus on the individual family member in front of them that they brought into their homes to live a good life with. And yes, you can do that. Let's do that together.
Kind of like the person that is always asking, well, you know, I do sleep with my dog on the bed. I'm like, Does anybody mind? Yeah. If you're cool with that, I'm cool with it. That's not a problem. It's fine. Yes.
Big one. Yeah, Lauren. And I say, I wouldn't have it any other way in my house. So I'm with you on that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, positive reinforcement to your clients. That's, you know, that's important too. They need that, you know, like you're capturing that it's okay. This is good. You know,
we all need it. That's absolutely certain. Yes. And I think that, one thing that's really helped me, and it goes right back to Ollie, what you were saying about habit stacking, is breaking it down into chewable chunks, you know, so you're not giving them so much to do that all of a sudden they're just like, okay, I have to like my schedule in order for me to be able to fix this or do it in a certain way. It's highly, highly improbable that they're going to be able to do that because yes, behavior change, it does take time. And the bigger the change, the bigger the delta, more difficult it's going to be. And if we can help them integrate small changes into what they're doing already, that really makes it a lot easier for them to be able to then implement any big change. It's kind of like, changing your eating habits and that kind of a thing. It's like, okay, yeah, you're going to cut out all carbs immediately, go cold turkey. Or you're going to drop sugar and that's it. You're going to feel like crap. And chances are that you're going to get to day whatever and say, I can't, you know, I'm stressed. My life is crazy. That's too much for me to do. It's no different than asking them to do way too many things, change things completely around and ask them to not be affected by their real lives, which yeah, life is complicated and it's stressful. And some days you're going to be more likely to do it. Other days you're just going to be like, I have no bandwidth or no energy. And they need to know that it's okay to do what they can. But also for us to also be sure that we're being conscious of the amount of change that we're asking them to do.
Yeah, I think in the past some people say it's easy as 5 minutes a day, which is great, but it's not always 5 minutes a day because like my triathlon trainer is like, oh, I only give you 45 minutes of a workout. It's like, yeah, but I have to get to the trail. I have to bring all my stuff. I have to shower afterwards. Like this is taking me 2 hours, lady. Just kidding. Love you, Leslie. But if you think about, okay, you just have to get your treats out. You have to get your dog ready. You have to put your work down. You have to put the kid away, the cat away, whatever. It takes some time. So that's why I'm advocating for less time and from Atomic Habits, pairing it with something else. So like an example, if I taught my client touch, if I wanted them to work on touch, leash walking and weight the first week, I would watch them interact with their dog. I know that they feed their dog. I know that they walk their dog and I know that they, maybe they go and get the mail from somewhere. So for this client, when they put the food in the bowl and they're going to feed the dog, I ask them to practice touch once, twice, three times tops. And they're going to do that twice a day because they have to feed the dog. Then it takes them, 30 seconds or less, then to wait at the door before they leave, because they're at least going to walk their dog twice, four times a day. Then if they're going to go get the mail, I ask them to try and do it after they walk their dog so that they can walk their dog. They come back in, go out and go get the mail and work with their dog on loose leash walking to go get the mail. Because their dog has just been hopefully running outside, sniffing on a long line or something. So by pairing those training moments with a thing that they're already going to do, I think that's what will help them make a habit of training. And then it becomes hopefully a lifelong thing that now the dog always goes to get the mail with them and always walks at their side nicely because they've been doing it for every day for a year. So that's what I was kind of hoping to discuss today with our habit stacking.
I love that. And thank you, Ali, for suggesting this topic. I think it's a really cool one to explore. And we are That was an hour. I mean, this goes so quickly always, and there's such great advice from all of our panelists. And I just want to thank you all for the work you do to truly move the needle to where dog training should be going to, which obviously is the philosophy of being humane and kind, and, you know, guiding dogs into living successfully with us. That's basically, you know, that's the essence of it, isn't it? So thanks, everybody. Thank you to all of our people who have joined. I'm afraid that we can't get to everybody in the chat, but we really appreciate you coming on here. And we will be back again next month on a, you know, please do suggest different topics. We always love that. And we'll see what we pick next month. But thank you, Ali. Thank you, everybody. And to all of you, take care. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to Victoria Stillwell's Positively Podcast. For Victoria's online dog training courses, more information, and helpful dog training tips, visit Victoria's official website at positively.com. Get connected on Facebook, Instagram, and other social media as Victoria Stillwell, and follow her on Twitter at Victoria S. Learn to become a professional dog trainer with the Victoria Stillwell Academy at vsdogtrainingacademy.com. And be sure to tune in next time as Victoria helps you and your dog live your best life together. Positively.